conceive of guests later reporting his sentiments to the Tokugawa government. Footsteps approached along the outside corridor. The small, thin man who entered the room wore a sleeveless cloak with only a short sword in the front of his obi. There was an air of modesty about him. Dropping to his knees and bowing to the floor, Yukimura said, "Forgive me for sending my son to bring you and for interrupting your journey." This show of humility made Sado uncomfortable. From the legal viewpoint, Yukimura had given up his status. He was now only a ronin who had taken the Buddhist name Denshin Geso. Nevertheless, he was the son of Sanada Masayuki, and his older brother, Nobuyuki, was a daimyo and had close connections with the Tokugawas. Being only a retainer, Sado was of much lower rank.
"You shouldn't bow to me that way," he said, returning the greeting. "It's an unexpected honor and pleasure to meet you again. I'm glad to see you're in good health."
"You seem to be too," replied
Yukimura, relaxing while Sado was still bowing.
"I'm pleased to hear Lord Tadatoshi has returned to Buzen safely."
"Thank you.
This is the third year since Lord Yusai passed away, so he thought it was time."
"Has it been that long?"
"Yes, I've been in Buzen myself, though I have no idea what use Lord Tadatoshi might have for a relic like myself. I served his father and grandfather, too, as you know."
When the formalities were over and they began talking of this and that, Yukimura asked,
"Have you seen our Zen master recently?"
"No, I've seen or heard nothing of Gudo for some time. That reminds me, it was in his meditation room that I first saw you. You were only a boy then, and you were with your father."
Sado smiled happily as he reminisced about the time he had been put in charge of constructing the Shunpoin, a building the Hosokawas had donated to the Myoshinji.
"A lot of hellions came to Gudo to get the rough edges smoothed off," said Yukimura.
"He accepted them all, not caring whether they were old or young, daimyo or ronin.
Actually, I think he particularly liked young ronin," mused Sado. "He used to say that a true ronin did not seek fame or profit, did not curry favor with the powerful, did not attempt to use political power for his own ends, did not exempt himself from moral judgments. Rather, he was as broad-minded as floating clouds, as quick to act as the rain, and quite content in the midst of poverty. He never set himself any targets and never harbored any grudges."
"You remember that after all these years?" asked Yukimura.
Sado nodded ever so slightly.
"He also maintained that a true samurai was as hard to find as a pearl in the vast blue sea. The buried bones of the innumerable ronin who sacrificed their lives for the good of the country he likened to pillars supporting the nation."
Sado looked straight into Yukimura's eyes as he said this, but the latter did not seem to notice the allusion to men of his own adopted status.
"That reminds me," he said. "One of the ronin who sat at Gudo's feet in those days was a young man from Mimasaka named Miyamoto..."
"Miyamoto Musashi?"
"That's it, Musashi. He impressed me as being a man of great depth, even though he was only about 20 at the time, and his kimono was always filthy."
"It must be the same man."
"Then you do remember him?"
"No, I didn't hear of him until recently when I was in Edo."
"He's a man to watch. Gudo said that his approach to Zen was promising, so I kept an eye on him. Then he suddenly disappeared. A year or two later, I heard he'd won a brilliant victory against the House of Yoshioka. I remember thinking at the time that Gudo must have a very good eye for people.
I came across him quite by accident. He was in Shimosa and gave some villagers a lesson in how to protect themselves from bandits. Later, he helped them turn a tract of wasteland into paddy.
I think he may be the true Ronin Gudo had in mind, the pearl in the vast blue sea.
Do you really think so? I recommended him to Lord Tadatoshi, but I'm afraid finding him is as hard as discovering a pearl. One thing you can be sure of, if a samurai like that took an official position, it wouldn't be for the sake of the income. He'd be concerned with how his work measured up to his ideals. It may be that Musashi would prefer Mount Kudo to the House of Hosokawa.
What?
Sato brushed off his remark with a short laugh, as if it were a slip of the tongue.
You're joking, of course, said Yukimura. In my present circumstances, I can hardly afford to hire a servant, let alone a well-known ronin. I doubt whether Musashi would come even if I did invite him.
There's no need to deny it, said Sado. It's no secret the Hosokawas are on the side of the Tokugawas, and everybody knows you are the support on which Hideyori leans most heavily. Looking at the scroll in the alcove, I was impressed by your loyalty.
Seemingly offended, Yukimura said,
The scroll was given to me by a certain person at Osaka Castle in lieu of a memorial portrait of Hideyoshi. I tried to take good care of it, but Hideyoshi is dead.
He swallowed and went on.
Times change, of course. It doesn't take an expert to see that Osaka has fallen on bad days, while the power of the Tokugawas continues to grow. But I'm not able by nature to change my loyalty and serve a second lord.
I wonder if people will believe it's that simple. If I may speak candidly, everybody says Hideyori and his mother furnish you great sums every year, and at a wave of the hand, you could muster 5 or 6,000 ronin.
Yukimura laughed deprecatingly.
Not a word of truth in it. I tell you, Sado, there's nothing worse than having people make you out to be more than you are.
You can't blame them. You went to Hideyoshi when you were young, and he liked you better than anyone else. I understand your father's been heard to say you're the Kusunoki Masashige or the Kung Ming of our times.
You embarrass me.
Isn't it true?
I want to spend the rest of my days here, quietly, in the shadow of the mountain where the Buddha's law is preserved. That's all. I'm not a man of refinement. It's enough for me if I can expand my fields a little, live to see my son's child born, have freshly made buckwheat noodles in the fall, eat fresh greens in the spring. Beyond that, I'd like to live a long life, far removed from wars or rumors of war.
Is that really all there is to it?
Sado asked mildly.
Laugh if you will, but I've been spending my free time reading Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu. The conclusion I've come to is that life is enjoyment. Without enjoyment, what use is there in living?
Well, well,
exclaimed Sado, feigning surprise. They talked for another hour or so over cups of fresh tea served by Daisuke's wife. Eventually, Sado said,
I fear I've stayed too long, wasting your time with my chatter. Nuinosuke, shall we be going?
Don't hurry off, said Yukimura. My son and his wife have made some noodles. Poor country food, but I wish you'd have some with us. If you're planning to stop over at Kamuro, you have plenty of time.
Daisuke appeared just then to ask his father if he was ready to have the meal served. Yukimura stood up and led the way down a corridor to the back part of the house. When they were seated, Daisuke offered Sado a pair of chopsticks, saying,
"I'm afraid the food isn't too good, but try some anyway."
His wife, not accustomed to having strangers around, diffidently held out a sake cup, which Sado politely refused. Daisuke and his wife lingered a moment longer before excusing themselves.
"What's that noise I can hear?" asked Sado.
It sounded rather like a loom, though louder and with a slightly different quality.
"Oh, that! It's a wooden wheel for making cord. I'm sorry to say, I've had to put the family and servants to work braiding cord, which we sell to help with the finances."
Then he added,
"We're all used to it, but I suppose it might be annoying to anyone who's not. I'll send word to have it stopped."
"No, that's all right. It doesn't bother me. I'd hate to think I was holding up your work."
As he started to eat, Sado thought about the food, which sometimes provides insight into a man's condition. But he found nothing revealing there. Yukimura was not at all like the young samurai he had known years before. But he seemed to have shrouded his present circumstances in ambiguity. Sado then thought about the sounds he heard, kitchen noises, people coming and going, and a couple of times the clink of money being counted. The dispossessed daimyo were not accustomed to physical labor, and sooner or later they would run out of treasures to sell. It was conceivable that Osaka Castle had ceased to be a source of funds. Still, the idea of Yukimura in tight straits was oddly disturbing. He had been aware that his host might be trying to piece together bits of conversation to form a picture of how things were going with the house of Hosokawa, but there was no indication of this. What stood out about his recollections of their meeting was that Yukimura had not asked about his visit to Mount Koya. Sato would have answered readily, for there was nothing mysterious about it. Many years ago, Hosokawa Yusai had been sent by Hideyoshi to the Seiganji and had stayed for quite some time. He had left behind books, some writings, and some personal effects, which had become important keepsakes. Sato had gone through them, sorted them out, and arranged for the temple to turn them over to Tadatoshi. Nuinosuke, who hadn't moved from the veranda, cast an anxious look toward the back of the house. Relations between Edo and Osaka were strained, to say the least. Why was Sado taking a risk like this? He didn't imagine Sado to be in any immediate danger, but he'd learned that the lord of Kii Province, Asano Nagaakira, had instructions to keep a strict watch on Mount Kudo. If one of Asano's men reported that Sado had paid a secret visit to Yukimura, the shogunate would become suspicious of the house of Hosokawa.
"Now's my chance," he thought, as the wind suddenly swept through the forsythia and caria blossoms in the garden. Black clouds were forming rapidly, and it began to sprinkle. He hurried down the corridor and announced, "It's starting to rain, sir. If we're going to leave, I think now is the time."
Grateful for the opportunity to break away, Sado stood up immediately.
"Thank you, Nuinosuke," he said. "By all means, let's be on our way."
Yukimura refrained from urging Sado to stay overnight. He called Daisuke and his wife and said,
"Give our guests some straw rain capes, and you, Daisuke, go with them to Kamuro."
At the gate, after expressing thanks for Yukimura's hospitality, Sado said,
"I'm sure we'll meet again one of these days. Maybe it'll be another day of rain, or maybe there'll be a strong wind blowing. Until then, I wish you the best of health."
Yukimura grinned and nodded.
"Yes, one of these days."
For an instant, each man saw the other in his mind's eye, mounted on horseback and carrying a lance. But for the present, there was only the host bowing amidst falling apricot petals and the departing guest in a straw cape streaked with rain. As they walked slowly down the road, Daisuke said,
"It won't rain much, and this time of year we have a little shower like this every day."
Still, the clouds above Senjo Valley and the peaks of Koya looked threatening, and they unconsciously quickened their pace. Entering Kamuro, they were greeted by the sight of a man sharing the back of a horse with bundles of firewood and tied so tightly he couldn't move. Leading the horse was a white-robed priest who called Daisuke's name and ran toward him. Daisuke pretended not to notice.
"Someone's calling you," said Sado,
exchanging glances with Nuinosuke. Forced to take notice of the priest, Daisuke said,
"Oh, Rinshobo, sorry I didn't see you." "I've come straight from Kiima Pass," said the priest in a loud, excited voice. "The man from Edo, the one who we're told to watch for, I spotted him in Nara. He put up quite a fight, but we took him alive. Now, if we take him to Gesso and force him to talk, we'll find out—"
"What are you talking about?" broke in Daisuke.
"The man on the horse, he's a spy from Edo."
"Can't you shut up, you fool?"
hissed Daisuke. "Do you know who the man with me is? Nagaoka Sado of the House of Hosokawa. We rarely have the privilege of seeing him, and I'll not have you disturbing us with your silly joke."
Rinshobo's eyes, turning to the two travelers, betrayed his shock, and he barely caught himself before blurting out,
"House of Hosokawa?"
Sado and Nuinosuke were trying to look poised and indifferent, but the wind whipped at their rain capes, making them flap out like the wings of a crane and rather spoiling their efforts.
"Why?"
asked Rinshobo in a low voice. Daisuke drew him a little to one side and spoke in a whisper. When he returned to his guests, Sado said,
"Why don't you go back now? I'd hate to put you to any more trouble."
After watching them until they were out of sight, Daisuke said to the priest,
"How could you be so stupid? Don't you know enough to open your eyes before you open your mouth? My father wouldn't be pleased to hear about this." "Yes, sir. I'm sorry. I didn't know."
Despite his robes, the man was no priest. He was Toriumi Benzo, one of Yukimura's leading retainers. The Port.
"Konosuke! Konosuke! Konosuke!"
Iori couldn't seem to stop himself. He called the name over and over and over. Having found some of Gonosuke's belongings lying on the ground, he was convinced the man was dead. A day and a night had passed. He'd been in a walking daze, oblivious of his wariness. His legs, hands, and head were spattered with blood, his kimono badly torn. Seized by a spasm, he would look up at the sky and cry,
"I'm ready!"
or stare at the ground and curse.
"Have I gone crazy?"
he thought, suddenly feeling cold. Looking into a puddle of water, he recognized his own face and felt relieved. But he was alone, with no one to turn to, only half believing he was still alive. When he'd awoken at the bottom of the ravine, he couldn't remember where he'd been the past several days. It didn't occur to him to try to go back to the Kōgonji or Koyagyu. An object glinting with the colors of the rainbow caught his eye, a pheasant. He became aware of the fragrance of wild wisteria in the air and sat down. As he tried to make sense of his situation, thoughts of the sun captured his mind. He imagined it as being everywhere, beyond the clouds, among the peaks, in the valleys. He shifted to a kneeling position, clasped his hands, shut his eyes, and began praying. When he opened his eyes a few minutes later, the first thing he saw was a glimpse of ocean, blue and misty, between two mountains.
"Little boy," said a motherly voice, "are you all right?"
"Huh?" With a start, Iori turned his hollow eyes toward the two women who were staring at him curiously.
"What do you suppose is wrong with him, mother?"
asked the younger woman, regarding Iori with distaste.
Looking puzzled, the older woman walked over to Iori, and seeing the blood on his clothes, she frowned.
"Don't those cuts hurt?"
she asked. Iori shook his head. She turned to her daughter and said,
"He seems to understand what I say."
They asked his name, where he had come from, where he had been born, what he was doing here, and whom he had been praying to. Little by little, as he searched around for the answers, his memory came back. More sympathetic now, the daughter, whose name was Otsuru, said,
"Let's take him back to Sakai with us. Maybe he'd be useful in the shop. He's just the right age."
"That might be a good idea,"
said her mother, Osei.
"Will he come?" "He'll come. Won't you?"
Iori nodded and said,
"Uh-huh."
"Come along, then. But you'll have to carry our luggage."
"Oh."
Iori acknowledged their remarks with a grunt, but otherwise said nothing on the journey down the mountain, along a country road and into Kishiwada. But among people again, he became talkative.
"Where do you live?"
he asked.
"In Sakai."
"Is that near here?"
"No, it's near Osaka."
"Where's Osaka?"
"We'll take a ship from here and go to Sakai. Then you'll know."
"Really? A ship?" Excited by the prospect, he rattled on for several minutes, telling them how he'd ridden any number of ferry boats on the way from Edo to Yamato. But though the ocean wasn't far from his birthplace in Shimosa, he'd never been out to sea in a ship.
"That'll make you happy then, won't it?"
said Otsuru.
"But you mustn't call my mother auntie. Say madam when you speak to her."
"Oh."
"And you mustn't answer, huh. Say, yes, ma'am."
"Yes, ma'am."
"That's better. Now, if you stay with us and work hard, I'll see you're made a shop assistant."
"What does your family do?"
"My father's a shipping broker."
"What's that?"
"He's a merchant. He owns a lot of ships, and they sail all over Western Japan."
"Oh, just a merchant?"
sniffed Iori.
"Just a merchant? Why!"
exclaimed the girl. The mother was inclined to overlook Iori's bluntness, but the daughter was indignant. Then she hesitated, saying,
"I suppose he's never seen merchants other than candy sellers or clothing salesmen."
The fierce pride of the Kansai merchants took over, and she informed him that her father had 3 warehouses, large ones, in Sakai, and several tens of vessels. She gave him to understand that there were branch offices in Shimonoseki, Marukame, and Shikama, and that the services performed for the House of Hosokawa in Kokura were of such great importance that her father's ships had the status of official vessels.
"And," she went on, "he's allowed to have a surname and carry 2 swords like a samurai. Everyone in Western Honshu and Kyushu knows the name of Kobayashi Tarozaemon of Shimonoseki. In time of war, daimyo like Shimazu and Hosokawa never have enough ships, so my father is just as important as a general."
"I didn't mean to make you angry," said Iori. The two women laughed.
"We're not angry," said Otsuru. "But a boy like you, what do you know of the world?"
"I'm sorry." Turning a corner, they were greeted by the tang of salt air. Otsuru pointed to a ship tied up at Kishiwada Pier. It had a capacity of 500 bushels and was loaded with local produce.
"That's the ship we'll go home in," she said proudly.
The ship captain and a couple of Kobayashi agents came out of a dockside tea house to meet them.
"Did you have a nice walk?"
asked the captain.
"I'm sorry to say we're very heavily loaded, so I couldn't keep much space open for you. Shall we go on board?"
He led the way to the stern of the ship, where space had been partitioned off with curtains.
A red rug had been spread, and elegant Momoyama-style lacquered utensils contained an abundance of food and sake. Iori had the feeling he was entering a small, well-appointed room in a daimyo's mansion. The ship reached Sakai in the evening, after an uneventful voyage up Osaka Bay. The travelers went directly to the Kobayashi establishment, facing the wharf, where they were welcomed by the manager, a man named Sahei, and a large group of assistants who had gathered at the spacious entrance. As Osei was going into the house, she turned and said,
"Sahei, will you look after the child, please?"
"You mean the dirty little urchin who came off the ship?"
"Yes.
He seems quick-witted, so you should be able to put him to work, and do something about his clothes. He may have lice. See that he washes well, and give him a new kimono. Then he can go to bed."
Iori didn't see the mistress of the house or her daughter for the next few days. There was a half-length curtain separating the office from the living quarters in the back. It was like a wall. Without special permission, not even Sahei dared go beyond it. Iori was given a corner of the shop, as the office was called, in which to sleep, and though he was grateful for being rescued, he soon became dissatisfied with his new way of life. The cosmopolitan atmosphere into which he'd been dropped had a certain fascination. He gaped at the foreign innovations he saw on the streets, at the ships in the harbor, and the signs of prosperity evident in the way people lived. But it was always, "Hey, boy, do this! Do that!" From the lowest assistant to the manager, they made him chase around like a dog. Not at all like their attitude when speaking to a member of the household or a customer. Then they turned into fawning sycophants. And from morning to night, they talked of money, money. If it was not that, it was work, work. "And they call themselves human beings," thought Iori. He longed for the blue sky and the smell of warm grass under the sun and decided any number of times to run away. The yearning was strongest when he remembered Musashi talking about ways of nourishing the spirit. He visualized how Musashi had looked and the face of the departed Gonnosuke and Otsu. Matters came to a head one day when Sahei called, "Iyo! Iyo! Where are you?" Getting no answer, he stood up and walked to the black-lacquered keyaki beam forming the threshold of the office. "You there, the new boy," he shouted. "Why don't you come when you're called?" Iori was sweeping the walk between the office and the storehouse. He looked up and asked, "Were you calling me?"
"Were you calling me, sir?"
"I see."
"I see, sir."
"Yes, sir."
"Don't you have ears? Why didn't you answer me?"
"I heard you say Iyo. That couldn't be me. My name is Iori, sir."
"Iyo's enough. And another thing, I told you the other day to stop wearing that sword."
"Yes, sir."
"Give it to me."
Iori hesitated a moment, then said,
"It's a keepsake from my father. I couldn't let go of it."
"Impudent brat! Give it to me."
"I don't want to be a merchant anyway."
"If it weren't for merchants, people couldn't live," Sahei said forcefully. "Who'd bring in goods from foreign countries? Nobunaga and Hideyoshi are great men, but they couldn't have built all those castles, Azuchi, Jirakudai, Fushimi, without the help of merchants. Just look at the men here in Sakai, Namban, Ruzong, Fukien, Amoy. They're all carrying on trade on a large scale."
"I know that."
"How would you know?"
"Anybody can see the big weaving houses at Ayamachi, Kinumachi, and Nishikimachi, and up on the hill, Luzonya's establishment looks like a castle. There are rows and rows of warehouses and mansions belonging to rich merchants. This place, well, I know Madam and Otsuru are proud of it, but it doesn't amount to anything by comparison."
"Why, you little son of a bitch!"
Sahei was barely out the door before Iori had dropped his broom and fled. Sahe summoned some dock workers and ordered them to catch him. When Iori was dragged back, Sahe was fuming.
"What can you do with a boy like that? He talks back and makes fun of all of us. Punish him good today."
Going back into the office, he added,
"Take that sword away from him."
They removed the offending weapon and tied Iori's hands behind him. When they fastened the rope to a large crate of cargo, Iori looked like a monkey on a leash.
"Stay there a while," said one of the men, smirking. "Let people make fun of you."
The others guffawed and went back to their work. There was nothing Iori hated more than this. How often Musashi and Gonnosuke had admonished him not to do things he might be ashamed of. First he tried pleading, then promised to mend his ways. When this proved ineffective, he switched to invective.
"The manager's a fool, crazy old fart. Let me loose and give me back my sword. I won't stay in a house like this."
Sahe came out and shouted,
"Quiet!"
He then tried to gag Iori, but the boy bit his finger, so he gave up and had the dock workers do it. Iori tugged at his bonds, pulling this way and that. Already under a terrible strain from being exposed to public view, he burst into tears when a horse urinated and the foamy liquid trickled toward his feet. As he was quieting down, he saw something that almost made him faint. On the other side of a horse was a young woman, her head protected from the sweltering sun by a broad-brimmed lacquered hat. Her hemp kimono was tied up for traveling, and she carried a thin bamboo pole. In vain, he tried to cry out her name. Stretching his neck out, he almost choked with the effort. His eyes were dry, but his shoulders shook with his sobbing. It was maddening. Otsu was so near. Where was she going? Why had she left Edo? Later in the day, when a ship tied up at the pier, the neighborhood became even busier.
"Sahe, what's this boy doing out here, looking like a trained bear on exhibit? It's cruel to leave him like that. It's also bad for business."
The man calling into the office was a cousin of Toro Zaemon. He was usually called Nambanya, the name of the shop where he worked. Black pockmarks added a certain sinisterness to the anger in his face. Despite his appearance, he was a friendly man and often gave sweets to Iori.
"I don't care if you are punishing him," he continued. "It's not right to do it out on the street. It's bad for the Kobayashi name. Untie him."
"Yes, sir,"
Sahe complied immediately, all the while regaling Nambanya with a detailed account of how useless Iori was.
"If you don't know what to do with him," said Nambanya, "I'll take him home with me. I'll speak to Osei about it today."
The manager, fearing the consequences when the mistress of the house heard what had happened, suddenly had an urge to soothe Iori's feelings. Iori, for his part, wouldn't have anything to do with the man for the rest of the day. On his way out that evening, Nambanya stopped in Iori's corner of the shop. A little drunk, but in high spirits, he said,
"Well, you won't be going with me after all. The women wouldn't hear of it. Ha!"
His conversation with Osei and Otsuru did have one salutary effect, however.
The very next day, Iori entered a temple school in the neighborhood. He was allowed to wear his sword to school, and neither Sahe nor the others gave him further trouble. But still, he was unable to settle down. When he was inside, his eyes often strayed to the street. Every time a young woman, even remotely like Otsu, passed, his color changed. Sometimes he ran out for a closer look. One morning, toward the beginning of the ninth month, a prodigious quantity of luggage began arriving by riverboat from Kyoto. By midday, chests and baskets were piled high in front of the office. Tags identified the property as that of Samurai in the House of Hosoka. They had been in Kyoto on business similar to that which had brought Sado to Mount Koya, looking after the posthumous affairs of Hosokawa Yusai. Now they sat drinking barley tea and fanning themselves, some in the office, some under the eaves outside. Coming back from school, Iori got as far as the street. He stopped and turned pale. Kojiro, seated atop a large basket, was saying to Sahei, "It's too hot out here. Hasn't our ship docked yet?" Sahei looked up from the manifest in his hands and pointed toward the pier.
"Your ship is the Tatsumi Maru. It's right over there. As you can see, they haven't finished loading, so your places on board aren't ready yet. I'm sorry."
"I'd much prefer to wait on board. It should be a little cooler there."
"Yes, sir. I'll go and see how things are coming along."
Too rushed to wipe the sweat from his forehead, he scurried out to the street, where he caught sight of Iori.
"What are you doing there, looking as though you'd swallowed a ramrod? Go and wait on the passengers. Barley tea, cold water, hot water. Give them whatever they want."
Iori went to a shed at the entrance of the alley by the storehouse, where a kettle of water was kept boiling. But instead of going about his business, he stood glaring at Kojiro. He was usually called Gandyu now, the rather scholarly-sounding name seeming more appropriate to his present age and status. He was heavier and more solid. His face had filled out. His once piercing eyes were serene and untroubled. He no longer made frequent use of his rapier tongue, which in the past had caused so much injury. Somehow, the dignity of his sword had become a part of his personality. One result was that he had gradually been accepted by his fellow samurai. They not only spoke highly of him, but actually respected him. Pouring sweat, Sahei returned from the ship, apologized again for the long wait, and announced,
"The seats amidship are still not ready, but those in the prow are."
This meant the foot soldiers and younger samurai could go on board. They proceeded to gather up their belongings and left in a group. There remained only Kojiro and 6 or 7 older men, all officials of some importance in the fief.
"Sato hasn't come yet, has he?" said Kojiro. "No, but he should be here before long."
"We'll be getting the sun from the west soon," Sahei said to Kojiro. "It'll be cooler if you move inside."
"The flies are terrible," complained Kojiro, "and I'm thirsty. Could I have another cup of tea?"
"Right away, sir."
Without getting up, Sahei shouted toward the hot water shed.
"Iyo, what are you doing? Bring some tea for our guests."
He busily addressed himself to his manifest again, but realizing Iori had not answered, he started to repeat his order. Then he saw the boy approaching slowly with several cups of tea on a tray. Iori offered tea to each of the samurai, bowing politely each time. Standing before Kojiro with the last two cups, he said,
"Please, have some tea."
Kojiro absent-mindedly extended his hand, but abruptly withdrew it as his eyes met Iori's. Startled, he exclaimed,
"Why, it's—"
Breaking into a grin, Iori said,
"The last time I had the bad luck to run into you was in Musashino."
"What's that?"
rasped Kojiro, in a tone hardly appropriate to his present status. He was about to say something else when Iori shouted,
"Oh, you remember me!"
and slung the tray at his face.
"Oh!"
cried Kojiro, grabbing Iori by the wrist. Though the tray missed him, a bit of hot tea caught him in the left eye. The rest of the tea spilled onto his chest and lap. The tray crashed into a corner post.
"You little bastard!" shouted Kojiro.
He threw Iori onto the dirt floor and planted one foot on top of him.
"Manager!"
he called angrily.
"This brat is one of your boys, isn't he? Come here and hold him down. Even if he is only a child, I won't stand for this."
Frightened out of his wits, Sahei rushed to do as he was told, but somehow Iori managed to draw his sword and take a swing at Kojiro's arm. Kojiro kicked him to the middle of the room and jumped back a pace. Sahei turned and rushed back, screaming his lungs out. He reached Iori just as the boy jumped to his feet.
"You keep out of this!"
Iori cried then, looking Kojiro straight in the face. He spat out, "Serves you right!" and ran outside. Kojiro picked up a carrying pole that happened to be handy and threw it at the boy, scoring a perfect hit behind his knee. Iori landed flat on his face. At Sahe's command, several men fell on Iori and hauled him back to the hot water shed, where a servant was wiping off Kojiro's kimono and hakama.
"Please, forgive this outrage," pleaded Sahe.
"We don't know how to apologize," said one of the assistants.
Without looking at them, Kojiro took a damp towel from the servant and wiped off his face. Iori had been forced to the ground, his arms bent tightly behind him.
"Let me go,"
he begged, his body writhing in pain.
"I won't run away. I'm a samurai's son. I did it on purpose, and I'll take my punishment like a man."
Kojiro finished straightening his clothing and smoothed his hair.
"Let him go,"
he said quietly. Not knowing what to make of the placid expression on the samurai's face, Sahe stammered,
"Are you sure it's all right?"
"Yes, but..."
The word sounded like a nail being driven into a board.
"Although I have no intention of becoming involved with a mere child, if you feel he should be punished, I can suggest a method. Pour a dipperful of boiling water over his head. It won't kill him."
"Boiling water?"
Sahe recoiled at the suggestion.
"Yes. If you want to let him go, that's all right, too."
Sahe and his men looked at each other uncertainly.
"We can't let something like that go unpunished.
He's always up to no good.
He's lucky he didn't get killed. Bring a rope."
When they started to tie him, Iori fought off their hands.
"What are you doing?"
he screamed. Sitting on the ground, he said,
"I told you I wouldn't run away, didn't I? I'll take my punishment. I had a reason for doing what I did. A merchant might apologize, not me. The son of a samurai is not going to cry over a little hot water."
"All right," said Sahe. "You asked for it."
He rolled up his sleeve, filled a dipper with boiling water, and walked slowly toward Iori.
"Shut your eyes, Iori. If you don't, you'll go blind."
The voice came from across the street. Not daring to look to see whose voice it was, Iori shut his eyes. He recalled the story Musashi had told him once in Musashino. It was about Kaisen, a Zen priest highly revered by the warriors of Kai province. When Nobunaga and Ieyasu attacked Kaisen's temple and put it to the torch, the priest seated himself calmly in the upper floor of the gate and, while burning to death, uttered the words, "If your heart is obliterated through enlightenment, the fire is cool."
"It's only a little dipper of hot water," Iori told himself. "I mustn't think that way."
He tried desperately to become a selfless void, free of delusion, without sorrows. Perhaps if he had been younger or much older. But at his age, he was too much a part of the world he lived in.
When was it coming?
For a giddy moment, he thought the sweat dripping from his forehead was boiling water. A minute seemed like 100 years.
"Why, it's Sado," said Kojiro.
Sahe and all the others turned and stared at the old samurai.
"What's going on here?"
Sado asked, coming across the street with Nuinosuke at his side.
Kojiro laughed and said lightly, "You caught us at an odd moment. They're punishing the boy."
Sado looked intently at Iori.
"Punishing him? Well, if he's done something bad, he should be punished. Go right ahead. I'll watch."
Sahe glanced out of the corner of his eye at Kojiro, who sized the situation up immediately and knew he was the one who would be held responsible for the severity of the punishment.
"That's enough,"
he said. Iori opened his eyes. He had a little trouble focusing them, but when he recognized Sado, he said happily,
"I know you. You're the samurai who came to the Tokuganji in Hotengahara.
You remember me?
Yes, sir.
What happened to your teacher, Musashi?
Iori sniffled and put his hands to his eyes. Sado's knowing the boy came as a shock to Kojiro. Thinking about it for a moment, he decided it must have something to do with Sado's search for Musashi. But he certainly didn't want Musashi's name to come up in a conversation between himself and the senior retainer. He knew that one of these days he would have to fight Musashi, but it was no longer a strictly private matter. In fact, a split had developed in both the main line and the branches of the House of Hosokawa, one faction thinking highly of Musashi, the other partial to the former Ronin who is now the clan's chief sword instructor. Some said the real reason the fight was inevitable was behind-the-scenes rivalry between Sado and Kakube. To Kojiro's relief, the boatswain of the Tatsumimaru arrived just then with word that the ship was ready. Sado, remaining behind, said, "The ship doesn't leave till sundown, does it?"
"That's right,"
replied Sahe, who was pacing about the office, worrying about the consequences of today's affair.
"I have time for a little rest, then."
"Plenty of time. Please, have some tea."
Otsuru appeared at the inner door and beckoned to the manager. After listening to her for a couple of minutes, Sahe came back to Sado and said,
"The office is not really the place to receive you. It's only a step through the garden to the house. Would you mind going there?"
"That's very kind," replied Sado. "To whom am I indebted? The lady of the house?"
"Yes, she said she'd like to thank you."
"What for?"
Sahe scratched his head.
I imagine foreseeing that Iori came to no harm. Since the master isn't here..."
"Speaking of Iori, I'd like to talk to him. Would you call him?"
The garden was what Sado would have expected in the house of a rich Sakai merchant. Though bounded on one side by a storehouse, it was a world apart from the hot, noisy office. Rocks and plants were all freshly watered, and there was a running brook. Osei and Otsuru were kneeling in a small, elegant room facing the garden. There was a wool rug on top of the tatami and trays of cakes and tobacco. Sado noticed the spicy fragrance of mixed incense. Sitting down at the edge of the room, he said,
"I won't come in. My feet are dirty."
While serving him tea, Osei apologized for her employees and thanked him for saving Iori. Sado said,
"I had occasion some time ago to meet that boy. I'm happy to have found him again. How does it happen he's staying in your house?"
After hearing her explanation, Sado told her about his long search for Musashi. They chatted amiably for a while, then Sado said,
"I was watching Iori from across the street for several minutes. I admired his ability to remain calm. He conducted himself very well. As a matter of fact, I think it's a mistake to raise a boy with that much spirit in a merchant's establishment. I wonder if you wouldn't consent to turning him over to me. In Kokura, he could be brought up as a samurai."
Osei agreed readily, saying,
"It would be the best thing that could possibly happen to him."
Otsuru got up to go look for Iori, but just then he emerged from behind a tree where he had overheard the whole conversation.
"Do you object to going with me?" asked Sado.
Bursting with happiness, Iori begged to be taken to Kokura. While Sado drank his tea, Otsuru got Iori ready for the trip. Kimono, hakama, leggings, basket hat, all new. It was the first time he had ever worn a hakama. That evening, as the Tatsumimaru spread its black wings and sailed forth under clouds turned golden by the setting sun, Iori looked back at a sea of faces. Otsuru's, her mother's, sahes, those of a large group of well-wishers, the face of the city of Sakai. With a broad smile on his face, he took off his basket hat and waved at them. The Writing Teacher. The sign at the entrance to a narrow alley in the fishmonger's district of Okazaki read, "Enlightenment for the Young, Lessons in Reading and Writing," and bore the name Muka, who was, from all appearances, one of the many impoverished but honest ronin making a living by sharing his warrior-class education with the children of commoners. The curiously amateurish calligraphy brought a smile to the lips of passers-by, but Muka said he wasn't ashamed of it. Whenever it was mentioned, he always replied in the same way, "I'm still a child at heart. I'm practicing along with the children." The alley ended in a bamboo grove, beyond which was the riding ground of the House of Honda. In fair weather, it was always covered by a cloud of dust, since the cavalrymen often practiced from dawn to dusk. The military lineage they were so proud of was that of the famous Mikawa warriors, the tradition that had produced the Tokugawas. Muka stirred from his midday nap, went to the well, and drew water. His solid gray, unlined kimono and gray hood might well have been the dress of a man of 40, but he was in fact not yet 30. After washing his face, he walked into the grove, where he cut down a thick bamboo with a single sword stroke. After washing the bamboo at the well, he went back inside. Blinds hanging on one side kept out the dust from the riding ground, but since this was the direction from which light came, the one room seemed smaller and darker than it actually was. A board lay flat in one corner. Above it hung an anonymous portrait of a Zen priest. Muka set the piece of bamboo on the board and tossed a bindweed flower into the hollow center. "Not bad," he thought, as he backed away to examine his work. Sitting down in front of his table, he took his brush and began practicing, using as models a manual on squarish, formal characters by Chu Sui Liang and a rubbing of the priest Kobo Daishi's calligraphy. He had evidently been progressing steadily during the year he had lived there, for the characters he wrote now were far superior to the ones on the sign.
"May I trouble you?"
asked the woman from next door, the wife of a man who sold writing brushes.
"Come in, please," said Muka.
"I only have a minute. I was just wondering. A few minutes ago I heard a loud noise. It sounded like something breaking. Did you hear it?"
Muka laughed. "That was only me, cutting down a piece of bamboo."
"Oh, I was worried. I thought something might have happened to you. My husband says the samurai prowling around here are out to kill you."
"It wouldn't matter if they did. I'm not worth 3 coppers anyway."
"You shouldn't be so easygoing. Lots of people get killed for things they don't even remember doing. Think how sad all the girls would be if some harm came to you."
She went on her way, not asking, as she often did, "Why don't you take a wife?
It isn't that you don't like women, is it?"
Muka never gave a clear answer, though he'd brought it on himself by carelessly revealing enough to suggest that he would make a fine catch. His neighbors knew he was a ronin from Mimasaka who liked to study and had lived for a time in Kyoto and in and around Edo. He professed to want to settle down in Okazaki and run a good school. Since his youth, diligence and honesty were apparent. It wasn't surprising that a number of girls had shown an interest in marriage, as well as several parents with eligible daughters. This small corner of society had a certain fascination for Muka. The brush seller and his wife treated him kindly, the wife teaching him how to cook and sometimes doing his washing and sewing. All in all, he enjoyed living in the neighborhood. Everybody knew everybody else, and all sought out new ways to make their lives interesting. There was always something going on. If not a festival or street dances or a religious celebration, then a funeral or a sick person to be cared for. That evening, he passed the brush seller's house as he and his wife were having dinner. With a click of her tongue, the wife said, "Where does he go? He teaches the children in the morning, takes a nap or studies in the afternoon, then in the evening he's gone. He's just like a bat." Her husband chuckled.
"What's wrong with that? He's single. You ought not to begrudge him his nightly excursions."
In the streets of Okazaki, the sounds of a bamboo flute mingled with the buzzing of captive insects in wooden cages, the rhythmical wail of blind street singers, the cries of vendors of melons and sushi. There was nothing here of the frantic bustle that characterized Edo. Lanterns flickered. People strolled about in summer kimono. In the lingering heat of a summer day, everything seemed relaxed and in its place. As Muka passed, the girls whispered, "There he goes again, paying no attention to anybody as usual." Some of the young women bowed to him, then turned to their friends and speculated on his destination. Muka walked straight on, past the side streets where he might have purchased the favors of the Okazaki harlots, regarded by many to be one of the chief local attractions along the Tokaido High Road. At the western edge of town, he stopped and stretched, letting the heat out of his sleeves. Ahead of him were the rushing waters of the Yahagi River and the 208-span Yahagi Bridge, the longest on the Tokaido. He walked toward the thin figure waiting for him at the first post.
"Musashi!"
Musashi smiled at Matahachi, who was wearing his priest's robe. "Has the master returned?" he asked.
"No."
They walked across the bridge, shoulder to shoulder. On a pine-covered hill on the opposite bank stood an old Zen temple. Since the hill was known as Hachijo, the temple had come to be called Hachijoji. They climbed up the dark slope in front of the gate.
"How are things?" asked Musashi. "Practicing Zen must be difficult."
"It is," replied
Matahachi, bowing his bluish-shaved head dejectedly.
"I've often thought of running away. If I have to go through a mental torture to become a decent human being, I might as well put my head in a noose and forget about it."
"Don't let it discourage you. You're still only at the beginning. Your real training won't come until after you've appealed to the master and persuaded him to take you as a disciple."
"It's not always impossible. I've learned to discipline myself a little, and whenever I feel low, I think of you. If you can overcome your difficulties, I should be able to overcome mine."
"That's the way it should be. There's nothing I can do that you can't do too."
"Remembering Takuan helps. If it hadn't been for him, I'd have been executed."
"If you can bear up under hardship, you can experience a pleasure greater than the pain," Musashi said solemnly. "Day and night, hour by hour, people are buffeted by waves of pain and pleasure, one after the other. If they try to experience only pleasure, they cease to be truly alive. Then the pleasure evaporates."
"I'm beginning to understand."
"Think of a simple yawn. The yawn of a person who's been working hard is different from the yawn of a lazy man. Lots of people die without knowing the pleasure yawning can bring."
"I hear talk like that at the temple."
"I hope the day soon comes when I turn you over to the master. I want to ask him for guidance, too. I need to know more about the way."
"When do you suppose he'll come back?"
"It's hard to say. Zen masters sometimes float around the country like a cloud for 2 or 3 years at a time. Now that you're here, you should resolve to wait 4 or 5 years for him, if it comes to that."
"You too?"
"Yes. Living in that back alley, among poor and honest people, is good training. Part of my education. It's not time wasted." After leaving Edo, Musashi had passed through Atsugi. Then, driven by doubts about his future, he had disappeared into the Tanzawa Mountains to emerge 2 months later more worried and haggard than ever. Solving one problem only led him to another.